Welcome to Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Here's your host, Laura Turner.
Hello and welcome to another special edition of Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. I'm Laura Turner. Well, at the age of 28, with his Beijing-based science communications business doing well and a new relationship blossoming, our guest tonight woke from a colonoscopy to be told he had stage 3 colorectal cancer. Now, our guest has documented his journey from that moment of diagnosis in his powerful and inspiring memoir, The Patient Doctor, a title which so brilliantly captures a whole other part of his story, his quest to become a doctor and quest to put the heart back into healthcare. It is my pleasure to welcome Dr. Ben Bravery to Great Australian Lives. How are you, Doctor?
Good, thank you. And please call me Ben, by all means.
Are you sure?
Yes, absolutely.
Good. All right. Well, look, I appreciate you taking time out. You've taken an hour off the wards today just to talk to us, and that, you know, I'm honoured being a doctor in the in a pandemic. Are you on shifts around that? Day shifts, night shifts? What's life looking like for you right now?
So as a trainee doctor, the exact nature of my job changes every 6 months. So we rotate around different hospitals, and that means different shifts and different patients and different bosses. At the moment, I'm doing days because I look after a ward of 20 beds, and I'm the main doctor on that ward that's there day to day. There's a couple of senior doctors that look after the place as well, but I'm the day-to-day go-to for those 20 patients. And so it's kind of 8-ish to 5-ish with some weekend work, and you might get a few phone calls in the odd evenings, but at the moment it's pretty chilled.
Right. Well, that's good to hear. Now, I want to know from a person who's been in emergency a few times and in hospital care a few times, you're always told that the doctor's coming. And the doctor always takes ages, but I know that's because you're so busy. Can you tell me, when I'm lying in that hospital bed wanting to know what the hell's going on, what are you doing?
Wow, that's important. And that's actually a big thing I write about in the book, because there's this when you enter a hospital as a patient, you kind of go into an information void, don't you?
Yes.
You don't know what's going on around you. And it's really interesting because outside, like if you order Uber, you know exactly where it is, you know the star rating of that person, you know what the vehicle they're traveling on, you know what food you ordered, how much it cost, what you should tip. And then, you know, they can also communicate back to you, and you go into hospital and it's one way. It's from the hospital back to you. So it can be really frustrating. When you're told doctor is coming, they are most of the time coming, but they've got probably, I don't know, 10 to 20 things to do first. And part of the problem is the doctors are stretched because there aren't enough of them, to be frank, in the hospital. And no one but them knows the timetable. So someone might say, yes, the doctor is coming, but they don't actually know when. And the nurses don't know when, the junior doctors don't know when, the people collecting blood don't know when, and of course the patients don't know when. And you hit the nail on the head. That's something that's so simple, but isn't it frustrating?
Well, here's the thing. You just suggested it yourself. Can we create Uber for doctors, where I can follow you around in a little dot that goes around the hospital and scream at you when you turn around and go the other way? You've got a tracker on you.
Or give me a one star.
You could rate your doctor. Yeah. Imagine that. Yeah. Oh, my God.
Well, I was actually going to say, I think there's lots of opportunity to increase the information flow. So there's no reason why when you enter hospital, you can't be told exactly where you are in the system. So which tiny bit you occupy of all the people that presented, you know, in the last hour or the last 24 hours, kind of how important maybe some of those other things are that the doctor's doing. So, you know, you could use a traffic light system. You could be given an approximate wait time, which would be really helpful for telling your mum or your daughter or your uncle, like, when to come in. Because, like, the doctor's going to be here around one, right? It's better than I have no idea when they're coming. Clear your day. There's lots you could do actually to democratize that and increase that information flow.
Yeah, Yeah. And that is exactly, well, not exactly, but it is a big part of the reason you wrote The Patient Doctor. Congratulations on the release of an incredible book, a real insight. And, it, you know, it's got the other side of it, of course, which is your journey from cancer patient to being a practicing doctor. Now, you say in the intro, I wanted to become a doctor to help people like I had been helped. But during my cancer treatment, in the hospital stays, I noticed lots of stuff that needs fixing. Outside of not knowing where your doctor is, what else, for those who've not read the book yet, what else do you go into?
There's a mix of like kind of small things that seem niggly or almost like I'm complaining. And then there's some quite big things. So maybe we'll start with the niggly things that sound like I'm whinging. And I was really conscious of not sounding like I'm whinging because I'm really grateful, really, really grateful for the care I got. I had all the treatments under the sun for my cancer. It took a year and a half. I spent lots of time in hospital. It cost tens and tens of thousands of dollars. I didn't pay a cent. I had excellent, smart people coordinating that care. The small things are like not knowing when the doctor's coming. And then when they come, kind of that morning frenzy where they ward round, right? And it's such a foreign idea outside the hospital, but becomes totally normal when you're in there. You're in bed. It might be early. It might be late. The curtain's yanked back. There's a bunch of doctors there, a bunch of other people. You don't know who they are, maybe some med students. And all of a sudden you're getting questions fired at you about, are you farting and have your bowels opened and why aren't you eating and you have you had any fevers? And you're talking to these
what
people you don't really
stool?
Know about really intimate stuff. Yeah, exactly, exactly. So there's that. And then there's the whole kind of idea of like stripping someone back, you know, taking off their clothes, putting on a gown, putting a barcode around their wrist. Maybe reducing them to a bed number. So, you know, I became the, you know, the bowel cancer in bed 14. And then, you know, and then there's some big things like the fact that for a lot of people, we put them in mixed rooms. Now, that's okay a lot of the time. And sometimes I really enjoyed that socialization, that ability to talk. But often, and particularly at my most vulnerable, I really detested that invasion. And not only that, that's a two-way street. So sometimes I would see and hear things in the other beds that I had no understanding of. And when you don't understand what's going on, you think the worst. I remember one time in my hospital stay, I was next to an older man who had advanced disease. So, you know, cancer was much more significant than mine. And he was in a lot of pain. And for like three nights in a row, he begged the doctors to end his life.
Oh.
And I'm 28 and I'm laying there with bowel cancer surgery and big scars and I'm wondering if my pain will go away and if I'm
traumatic.
Going to end up like that. And that's okay if people are checking in with you, but no one asked. Like we just expect patients to block out the world around them. That's not how people work. So you've got rushed ward rounds. You don't know where your doctor is. Often when the doctors and nurses talk to you, you don't understand what they're saying. Your family are desperate for information. You're in busy workplaces, essentially, that aren't designed for you. They're designed for the workers. And a lot of the time when you're healthy and you bounce in for surgery and you bounce out again, these aren't a problem. But for people that get stuck there and don't heal like you're supposed to, like I did, they weigh you down. And I thought the kind of crux of it was that eventually you get reduced to a problem and they forget you're a person.
They can be really depressing places, hospitals. But of course, as you would know, there are some miracles there as well. I want to know about your lead up to this, the life that you're leading now. Correct me if I'm wrong. You're a zoologist living in Beijing.
Yeah, quite random, isn't it?
A man of many talents. You just met the love of your life and then this comes along. Tell me about that lead up.
Oh, so intense for so many reasons. I was 28. I had been in China 4 years by this point. I'd gone over as a zoologist to work on species conservation, right? Saving large mammals. That was kind of the thing I was interested in. And then I ended up in Beijing and working with a lot of giant panda researchers. So I became a little bit of an expert on giant pandas. And then I decided to set up my own business, helping Chinese researchers popularize their work, communicate it abroad, because this was just after the Olympics and China was so focused on the rest of the world. They didn't just have a, you know, aggressive economic and political policy. They had a scientific agenda, and they wanted their research to get out there, and they were spending so much money on this stuff. So I decided to help Chinese researchers promote their work in English and publish papers and engage with media. So I was busy building this business. It was, you know, just me and a couple of other people. We had no money. We were just using our networks. I was working long hours. And it was through this work that I met Sana, the person I fell in love with. She was a journalist at a radio station, and she wanted to interview me about giant pandas. So I went in and did the interview, and I asked her on a date that day, and it didn't Aww. End. So Stop I was it. Falling in love and really busy. I was building a future, but over about maybe 3 months, I'd been having these symptoms off and on. And initially, the diarrhea, the constipation, the cramps, I kind of put down to like maybe dodgy dumplings or a bad bowl of rice or something like that, right? It wasn't uncommon for me over 4 years in China to have a lot of gastro, let's be honest. Yeah. And then eventually I couldn't explain these things away. Then I started to bleed, which made things a bit more serious. It didn't happen all the time. It wasn't like every time I went to the bathroom, there was blood in the bowl, but it got increasingly worse. Then I grew pale. I fainted a couple of times. I got night sweats. I lost weight, but still, you know, when I Googled it, I just put it down to hemorrhoids. I had no family history of cancer. I was otherwise really fit and healthy. I was still going to yoga and jogging, trying to eat healthy. And I just didn't want to accept, or maybe didn't even think that something like that could be happening inside me.
How did you find out?
I eventually had to start telling people about what was going on in my body. The hard part is it's kind of gross, right? Like, it's not a little lump somewhere or a mole that changes color. You know, we're talking about poo. I hope it's okay to talk about poo on your program. We're talking about poo.
We got her.
And you know, and the closest person to me was my new girlfriend. And that's the last thing you want to be talking about. You want to be exploring each other's bodies in other ways, not that way. And so eventually I went on a little snowboarding trip with my dad when he came over, and I was rolling down the hill because I'm terrible at anything that involves sport. And that night I had a really big bleed back at the lodge, and I must have upset the tumor by falling and stacking and, you know, the snowboard flying off. And I decided the bleed was too big to ignore. It looked awful. There was a lot of blood. And I sat my dad down and I said, look, this is happening. And I laid it all out. And he said, okay, it's probably nothing, but you need to see a doctor. And I happened to be going back to Australia 2 weeks later. And I told my mum I was coming back to get a visa. And she said straight away, you have a colonoscopy. And even then it felt ridiculous. It felt like we were all being a bit dramatic, but she was right. And I had the colonoscopy back in Melbourne. And the last thing the doctor said to me before I went under, and he was an excellent doctor, but, you know, medicine is all about probability. And so he said to me, the last thing we expect to find here is anything serious like a cancer, because I had no family history and I looked well.
Yeah.
And then I woke up from the anesthetic. My mum was in the room, and obviously he tells me what he's found.
Did you go into shock?
Yeah, I did. I think that's what most people probably do, right? I went kind of numb. The words were coming out of his mouth. They didn't really feel like they were words directed at me. I was kind of, I'd stopped thinking. I didn't realize until he'd stopped talking that I was squeezing my mum's hand. And she asked all the questions, you know. She jumped in because she could see that I had kind of stopped processing things. And I thought of instantly all the people that didn't know. You know, here I was getting this really big piece of information. And there's all these other people. And my dad was out in the waiting room. He didn't know yet. Sana was back in Beijing on her way to work. She didn't know. And so my brain went to, I think I need to share this and tell people really quickly.
Yeah.
It felt that serious. Yeah, I did. I had to start telling people, and that's a whole other part of cancer.
Yeah. Well, I'm so glad you had your parents there to support you. Oh, this is Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, Celebrating Lives. Our guest tonight is Dr. Ben Bravery. And in a moment, Ben will take us into his world as a cancer patient and how it would forever change his life and his career path.
You're listening to Great Australian Lives with Laura Turner for Tobin Brothers Funerals, Celebrating Lives.
Welcome back to Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funeral, Celebrating Lives. I'm Laura Turner. Our guest tonight is Dr. Ben Bravery. He was just 28 when he was diagnosed with stage 3 colorectal cancer. He's since added doctor to his name and is on a quest to put the heart back into healthcare. Now, you write in your memoir, Dr. Ben Bravery, the patient doctor, that your mum is the exact kind of person you'd want to have next to you when you find out you've got cancer. Now, we heard before the break that you were squeezing her hand. She's asking all the questions. She's sort of, standing in for you and being the backbone when you needed it. In your childhood, was it just you and her?
For the first couple of years, she was a single mum. And then a couple of years after me, she had my sister. So there's just the two of us, and there was just the three of us. So she mainly raised us as a single mum. She had left high school at grade 10 to get a job, because that's what the family did. You got to work as soon as you could and got a job. You stayed loyal. You worked your way up the chain. Very strong work ethic in my family. And she had found herself pregnant with me. It wasn't planned. It was with someone she couldn't be with for a number of reasons. And so she packed me up and off we went. And she met my sister's father and quickly fell pregnant to him. They didn't last despite trying. And so it was us for a lot of it. And this was before, child support. This was before Centrelink. In the 80s. So if you didn't have the money, you didn't have the money. So often she worked, up to 3 jobs, did multiple shifts a day to give us the life she thought we deserved. A couple of times, things were really rough. She would skip meals so that we had enough food to eat. She's a very, very impressive person.
Yeah.
And she's strong. And she knows that life isn't always what you want it to be. She knows that. She's lived it. And she taught us that. And she taught us that things would get you down, but you could build. You could use what you had. She's very resourceful. And I think, at that moment when I was diagnosed, it was her greatest fear losing me. If I can divulge for a second, it's got extra importance with her and me because she wasn't sure actually when she was pregnant if she wanted to keep me, and she'd actually put me up for adoption. She thought that I needed a mum and a dad and people with good jobs who could provide for me, and she decided to adopt me, and she'd signed all the papers. And when I was born, I was whisked away from her because that was the policy back then. You were taken straight out of the room and stuck in a nursery for nurses to look after you until the social workers could come and pick you up. And the first day, she started to doubt whether it was the right decision. And the nurses tried to reassure her. I'm sure they'd seen 100 women change their mind. And she found one that was sympathetic, and she snuck her into the nursery late one night to hold me. And she changed her mind. So 2 days later, when the social workers came to pick me up, she's telling them through the door, she's locked the door to the room. And she's yelling through the door, he's mine, I'm keeping him. And the social workers are banging because they've seen people change their mind too, right? And they want the best for me. This advocate that stood up for mum is like, she screams, she's told you she's keeping him. And she says it was the greatest decision she ever made. And so when I was diagnosed and the thought she might lose me, it was almost too much.
Yeah,
but
wow.
But despite all that, she held on.
That is extraordinary. It would have brought back a lot of for her, of, as you say, that thought of losing you is just the worst possible thing for your mum. That is a spine tingling story. You must have such a close relationship with her, and how lucky you are to have her for a mum. The patient experience for you, so she was by your side when you were diagnosed, but you write in your book that during your cancer treatment, you felt rushed around wards where strangers, were sort of looming all around. Your body was being discussed as though you weren't there, scolded by nurses for wanting to look at your own medical record. at what point did you think, I want to take control of this. I want to bring myself into the other side of this world and try and change it.
It's so interesting because it wasn't then, I think I had a lot of processing to do. I had to fully feel what the cancer had done to me, how it had changed my body and my mind. I didn't have a magic light bulb moment. I'd love to say I jumped out of bed one day after a particular encounter and went, aha, I've got to be, the trick is becoming a doctor here. It wasn't like that. It was gradual. These things added up over time, and I kept a diary to remind myself of the frustrations. After cancer treatment, which was a year and a half, I went back to work here in Australia. China was gone. There was no way I could leave again. My business had gone. Sana was living here now. My friends had moved on. I had to start again. And I went back to work in Sydney and got about 6 months into a job before it just didn't feel right. I got agitated, a little frustrated, bored. So I changed jobs and that helped for a little bit. But again, about 6 months in, the same thing happened. And I realized that I needed to actually stop. So I took a whole year off from everything. And I did what I should have done at the end of treatment, and I just felt it, thought about it, and worked out what I wanted to do next. Yeah. But the reason I rushed back to work after cancer treatment was because I was 30. I had watched all my friends carry on, get engaged, try and have babies, get career progression, and I wanted that too. I was desperate for that normality. So I rushed back. It caught up with me. And in that year, these things came back to me about the ward rounds and the frustration. And I was still a patient having checkups, so I was still being challenged in lots of different ways. And I decided that what I needed to do now was to help people like I'd been helped, but try and make things better for the people after me. And I decided that the best way to do that was to go in at the top, so to speak, and become a doctor. Because it seemed as though in the hospital, doctors called the shots. They ran the place. Yeah. And they were the main thing that the main person that a patient deals with, and they're the main thing the patient remembers. So I thought, let's go in and be a doctor, and let's talk to other doctors about why the stuff I'm feeling matters as a patient, while also treating patients. And so it was gradual.
Yeah, that's normally people don't have light bulbs. That's very out of the movie. I'm glad you said that.
I wish I did though.
No, but I find that with most things in life, it's normally a gradual decision. This is Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funeral, celebrating lives. Our guest tonight is Dr. Ben Bravery, author now as well, and more with him and his incredible story in just a moment.
You're listening to Great Australian Lives with Laura Turner for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Welcome back to Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funeral, celebrating lives. Our guest tonight is Dr. Ben Bravery. Ben's memoir is out now. It's called The Patient Doctor, How One Man's Cancer Diagnosis Led to a Quest to Put the Heart Back into Healthcare. Now tell me, Dr. Ben Bravery, you're 32 years old, you walk into medical school, are they all turning around in class going, who's this guy?
Who's the old guy? Well, no. So I went. I did graduate medicine. So they're a little bit older. They've done a degree. Yep. You know, it still blows my mind that you can finish high school maybe late 16, 17 and start a medical degree and be a doctor by 21, 22. Just, it's incredible. So the average age in my degree was about 26. So I was still older, 32. I'm
Big
a classic
difference.
mature age student. I sit up the front. I've got a notebook. Everyone else has
You were
got
that
computers
annoying
because it had
person
been.
asking questions.
I was. It had been like 10 years since I was at uni and a lot had changed. So I was that person. No one knew I was sick or that I had been sick. That came out over time slowly. And the first thing that struck me about med school was it's weird. I wasn't ready for how odd it was. I was naive. It was often quite aggressive teaching, which would surprise a lot of people. But you hear about medical bullying and harassment. And some of that starts at medical school, actually. The teachers
Wow.
love quizzing you and they can be quite aggressive almost to humiliate you. I felt really early on that I'd almost been depersonalized or dehumanized a little bit as a student. And that made me think back to my experience as a patient, right? Being reduced to a bed number or a problem. And I started to see these connections with how doctors were treating each other and being taught, and how they were treating and interacting with patients. And I was a bit disappointed in that. I felt that going to med school, I'd be able to fix the patient side of things. And I realized that to do that, I also had to address the doctor side of the patient-doctor equation.
Wow. I've got to say, you're actually reminding me, Ben, when I had twins 3.5 years ago, and they were in the NICU and
Congratulations.
special care. Thank you.
Yep.
But you're sort of making memories pop into my head. I remember when they were in NICU, and we were so overwhelmed. They're our first children, and they're, clinging to, not clinging to life, but clinging to their health. And as you kind of described before, the team of doctors would burst in late in the afternoon, and they'd all be standing around and taking notes and poking and prodding and stretching and all this sort of thing. And you're sort of standing there as parents, not knowing what the hell was going on. But I do remember that sort of at times sort of transactional relationship you end up having with the hospital. Like they'd say, "Well, where's this paperwork? And why haven't you done that? And this person asked you this before," and you're kind of standing there going, "I don't even know what's going on. I don't know. I don't even, who are you? You know, I don't know which one's the doctor, and I don't know which nurses, like it's so overwhelming." I think for all the incredible work that the hospitals do, sometimes as you well describing, that softness gets forgotten, that heart gets forgotten. As parents, we're standing in the NICU for 12 hours a day on our feet, not sitting down, just cheering our babies on, and you're getting peppered with all this other stuff. You just get overwhelmed. And I think, yeah, your book is very useful in trying to bridge that gap.
I thank you so much for sharing that. I can't begin to imagine the trauma of a. I've got a 2-year-old. The birth was quite traumatic, and I discussed that at the end of the book. We thought at one point he wasn't going to make it, but I didn't need the NICU, thank God. And I've got full respect for the parents that go through that process. Your experience summarizes the stuff I'm talking about. So the reason this matters is because you're years down the track, and the technical stuff worked, right? I assume you. I don't know, but I assume your babies are okay.
Yes, they're being kept
Yeah.
quiet out the back as we speak.
Mine's been kept quiet in the other room. And so that technical stuff is done. The babies are well, and you kind of forget that. You're grateful for it, but you forget that. But what lingers is this other stuff. And what I try to say into the co my colleagues, because what I feel as a patient turned doctor is this stuff matters. And it matters because you are treating people. And the hospital is very foreign. People have no idea what's going on. It's not designed for the patients, which is surprising. It's designed for other reasons. And the little touches of humanity that we can instill in the way a question is asked and a gesture like a holding someone's hand or asking if they're okay, or sitting down to talk to them, or wearing a name badge so you know who they are. But there's so much stuff you can do just to inject that humanity. And the stuff I'm writing about, it's not rocket science. You know this. You felt it. Yeah. It's not rocket science. There's actually loads of stuff we can do that's simple.
Yeah, well, there was actually, I'm going to talk about myself again for a second because I'm so grateful for there was one nurse who I had an emergency seizure because I'd had a placental abruption. I was rushed into theatre and I'll never forget as they were putting me under, I said to this nurse, I looked her in the eye and said, are my babies going to be okay? I just want to know that. And she said, I can't guarantee that. And then everything went black. And I will never forget it. But that beautiful nurse personally took all these photos when they were born because I didn't get to see them, till the next day or one of them. But she took all these personally on her own camera, and personally had them printed out and everything so that when I woke up, I could see what they looked like and that they were alive. And I'm only telling you this because it is those personal touches. I'll never forget that woman. She knew this is a mother who needs to know as soon as she wakes up that her babies are okay. And it made such a shocking experience just that little bit easier because I knew there's someone there who cared about me. And, of course, everyone in the room cared about me because they saved my life and the babies. But the emotional side of it, as you were describing, is so important as well to take a bit of the trauma out of it. And if that lady's listening, I thank her from the bottom of my heart. I think about her all the time.
That is so lovely. And it's these little gestures. And you know what? That's not a hospital protocol. That's her acting out of her connection to patients.
Yep.
And we've got doctors. I say this, doctors have a lot to learn from nurses. At some point, we stopped learning from nurses. And doctors will come up and say to me now, like when I'm talking about the book, and say, but how do we protect ourselves from the feelings? I don't want to get too close to my patients. And I flip the question and I say, could you imagine saying that to a nurse or a psychologist? You would never say to them, don't get too close to the patient. We expect it from the other caring professions, but doctors somehow have remained immune from that expectation. What I'm saying is let's teach the junior doctors and the medical students this stuff. We can teach it.
Yeah.
We can teach them how to reflect on someone else's experience and to think like your nurse did. What might this person need? What might I need if I was in this situation?
Such important stuff. And to protect PTSD on both sides, for medical professionals and for patients as well. This is Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Our guest tonight is Dr. Ben Bravery, and we'll wrap things up with Ben in just a moment.
You're listening to Great Australian Lives with Laura Turner for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Welcome back to Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funeral, celebrating lives. Our guest tonight is Dr. Ben Bravery, whose experience on both sides of the healthcare system have inspired his work to ensure that we're all treated with care and compassion right until the very end. Now, Dr. Ben Bravery, I know you want me to call you Ben. I can't help it. It's such an honourable profession that you have taken up. I want to know, though, You mentioned earlier that you were, working with big mammals. You now work with people in hospital. Is there any difference?
Yes, a huge difference. So the thing as a zoologist is you can't talk to the people you're into, the animals you're interested in. But now job is talking. It's a huge relief to be able to ask someone what they're feeling and why they're doing something. I couldn't do that before in my old career. But in a serious note, that old career taught me to observe very carefully and to appreciate an animal within its habitat, because you can't interpret a whale without thinking about the ocean, right? And so when I approach patients, I remember that they're in a very strange habitat now. This is not their lounge room. The parts of them that represent their personality and make them feel comfortable aren't there, and that I've got to be very careful about making assumptions about them and ignoring things that might be important to them. So it's an odd leap, but there are some skills that I have taken over to medicine.
Yeah, in some ways you would be ahead of those other people at med school just because of that Well, in a lot of ways, because of that career that you'd had before you started that one. I want to know for you, Ben, now the book is out there, what is next for you? We know that healthcare workers are burnt out, they're tired at the moment because of this pandemic. What's next for you? Are you going to take a holiday? I mean, what's Ben going to do on his agenda next?
Yeah, so I'm still a junior doctor. We're kind of junior doctors for about 10 years. I've got 4 years to go of my specialty training. I'm 4 years out of medical school. So I'm busy learning my specialty, working in a busy hospital. All the hospitals are full at the moment. I'm under pressure every day to get people out the door to make way for people who are sick with COVID and other respiratory illnesses. We're all under that pressure. We're still in masks and goggles despite when you leave the hospital, no one wearing them on the outside. What's next for me is the whole point of this book was to pull my ideas together and keep the conversation going about how to make healthcare better. Now, I wrote the book before the pandemic, but the pandemic has made all this stuff front page news on a daily basis. There's some things we can do that I'm excited about. I'm talking to a couple of med schools. I'm talking to a couple of colleges. I'm actually in Melbourne this weekend talking to a bunch of cancer doctors who are about to graduate and be specialists about this stuff. There's an appetite in healthcare to do better, which gives me hope. And I want to start at the ground up, though. I think we need to increase the diversity at medical school. I think we let a lot of different people in from different backgrounds to shake things up. I think once they're in there, we teach them empathy, communication, validation, and patient stuff. I think we get patients into med school. I saw very few patients as actual teachers at med school. It horrified me. Your experience, could you imagine going into a room full of junior doctors and sharing your experience, what it would do to their understanding of obstetrics and gynecology and the NICU? It would be amazing. And because, you know, in medical school is a special place where we can blend illness experiences like yours with all the facts and figures. Both sides are important. I would love to see change on that space. And then once we pump out these amazing doctors, we've got to protect them. We know what happens. They become depressed. They become anxious. Yeah. I've got colleagues who are suicidal. You can't give good care if you're not cared for.
Yeah.
And so I want heart across the board. And I know I'm being a little idealistic, but what's next for me is to keep this conversation going, get to where I need to get to in order to convince the people that make the decisions that what I'm saying matters and that patients demand better.
Yeah, and you've got to aim high to land as high as you can. That's a great sell, Dr. Ben Bravery, for your new book, which is your memoir called The Patient Doctor, How One Man's Cancer Diagnosis Led to a Quest to Put the Heart Back into Healthcare. It is an honest and powerful read, as well as being eye-opening as well, and it is in all good bookstores now. So thank you, Dr. Ben Bravery, for being with us tonight. It has been great fun and a great insight.
Thank you very much, and thank you for sharing your story.
And of course, wherever you get your podcasts from, you can subscribe to the Great Australian Lives podcast and never miss an episode. And of course, catch up on conversations with some of our incredible guests, people like Sally Warriner.
Have a look who signed it. It was signed Sally Warriner, wife of the general manager. What was I thinking?
At one point, a friend of yours had tried to use the term management team as a descriptor for the work of women on stations. The men shot that down, didn't they?
With these managers' wives, who all work really hard, as well as their husbands, couldn't we call them management team? And he said, no, they're managers' wives, and that's accolade enough.
Fergus Watts.
Investing in the young person that isn't perceived to have any obvious issues on the surface, we're not really interested in. 5 years ago, we invested 1.34% of all health funding in preventative solutions. And 5 years later, we deal with something that pushed everyone's mental capacity to the edge. We're finding out that we're not equipped to deal with it. And unless we change our view as a society, unless we change where the value is, we're going to keep reliving the same cycle.
And of course, join me next week when we celebrate another episode of Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
You're listening to Great Australian Lives with Laura Turner for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.